Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Basha Cummings, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. This week, the story of a fall from grace, of a man who was at one point the most popular politician in the country, tipped to be the next prime minister, who, over the course of just 20 days, found his star rapidly descending. I'm talking, of course, about Rishi Sunak, the once unstoppable Chancellor of the Exchequer, whose future suddenly seems a lot less certain. And I'm handing over to my colleague, Matt D'Ancona, who's going to take you inside number 11 Downing Street.
You know, it's. I think it's totally fine for people to take shots at me. It's fair game. I'm the one sitting here, and that's what I signed up for. You know, it's actually. It's very upsetting, and I think wrong for people to try and come at my wife.
That's Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, talking to the BBC's outgoing political editor Laura Koonsberg on the 31st of March. You can hear it, can't you? That trace of hurt in the voice of this normally unflappable politician as he defends his family against a series of criticisms concerning their financial affairs, criticisms that, as we'll see, were only just beginning. That hurt surely reflected the natural desire of a husband to protect his wife, Akshata Murthy. But there was something else too, an undercurrent of disbelief. After decades of rising frictionlessly through the education system, the world of finance, and now to the heights of British politics, Sunak himself and his very integrity were being called to account. That sense of profound disbelief is at the heart of the story of Rishi Sunak's sudden fall from grace. It's a story of a modern-day Icarus propelled at remarkable speed towards the sun of political success, and then, no less suddenly, crashing into the sea. It's also the story of sharp tensions inside Downing Street between Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak during a period when calls for the PM's resignation were at their height, of political naivety on a grand scale, and crucially, the way in which the political landscape has been transformed by the cost of living crisis and the war in Ukraine. I'm Matt D'Ancona, and in this slow newscast from Tortoise, I'll be investigating the 20 days in which the political fortunes of the Chancellor collapsed with precipitate speed, how that collapse took shape, and what it means for the prospects of Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, and the Conservative government as a whole. I've spent the past few weeks talking to more than 20 senior ministers, MPs, officials, advisers, and other Westminster and Whitehall figures to find out what happened during an incredibly intense few weeks, a period of harsh awakenings, brutal backstabbing, and colossal setbacks in a hitherto immaculate political career. The story starts on Wednesday, the 23rd of March.
Right. We now come to the spring statement. I now call the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak.
Mr. Speaker, as I stand here, men, women and children are huddled in...
Little more than 2 years after he was appointed Chancellor at the precocious age of 39, Sunak was in a tight spot. The height of the pandemic, when announcing £330 billion worth of government emergency measures was all in a day's work for Rishi Sunak, now seemed a distant memory. For most of the COVID crisis, the Chancellor was Britain's most popular politician. Westminster's Mr. Bountiful, chucking cash in every direction with government-backed business loans, special funds or exemptions for sectors in dire need, and above all, the so-called furlough or job retention scheme. Back in 2020, Conservatives loved the scheme because it meant that redundancies were kept to a minimum during the health crisis. But so too did dyed-in-the-wool socialists like the hard-left union leader Len McCluskey. And, admiring Sunak from across the Atlantic, the US presidential contender Bernie Sanders, who said of the Conservative Chancellor's strategy, "That is the direction we should have gone here." But those days were now receding in the political rearview mirror. Though he had more fiscal headroom than expected, Sunak played it safe in the spring statement, preferring to keep a lid on borrowing rather than splashing cash on the surging cost of living crisis and on the rising cost of energy. A problem exacerbated, of course, by the Ukraine conflict.
Firstly, we're cutting fuel duty by 5 pence per litre, coming in tonight and saving a typical motorist £100 over the next year. Secondly, we're raising national insurance thresholds, delivering a tax cut to 30 million workers. And lastly, for the first time in 16 years, we will be cutting the basic rate of income tax, ensuring people keep more of what they earn.
But these measures felt like pretty thin gruel against the backdrop of soaring inflation at 8%, energy bills rising by more than 50%, and the tax burden set to reach its highest level since the 1940s. According to the Resolution Foundation think tank, the Chancellor's relative inaction was on course to push 1.3 million people, including 500,000 children, into absolute poverty. Which was obviously a very worrying forecast for a government so noisily committed to levelling up. But it was also a very important factor in all that was to follow for the Chancellor personally, and the extent to which his own side did or didn't rally to support him when the chips were down. As one of his allies admitted to me, "Yes, the reaction to the spring statement did a lot of damage to Rishi's political immune system. It was a fairly immediate thumbs down. We knew that the Teflon years of the pandemic were over. We knew that Labour would come after us, and they did. But we were really taken aback by the response on the Tory benches, which was pretty sullen. He felt pretty lonely." So on Thursday the 24th of March, Sunak was unusually defensive in his media round. Here he is talking to Sky's Beth Rigby.
"I can't ever in this job do all the things that people would like me to do, and I have to deal with that every single day. You know, I want to be the best possible person I can in this job because a lot of people are counting on me to do a really good job, and that's a big responsibility. Mm. There's a lot of challenges. And at the same time, I'm still a dad and I'm still a husband."
It was striking that the Chancellor should mention his role as a husband and family man at this particular moment, for that role was about to become uncomfortably and very publicly entangled with his political fate. The Chancellor's wife is Akshata Murthy, whom he met in 2004 at Stanford Business School in the United States. They married in 2009 and have two daughters, Krishna and Anushka. Akshata Murthy is also the daughter of N.R. Narayana Murthy, who founded the global software giant Infosys in 1981. And often described as India's Bill Gates. She holds 0.9% of the company's shares, which have been valued at £690 million and are estimated to have yielded £11.5 million in dividend payments over the past year. This means that, on paper at least, she is a lot richer than the Queen. On the very day that her husband was under fire over the inadequacy of his spring statement, it emerged that Infosys had continued to operate in Russia during the Ukraine conflict. How, then, did the Chancellor square his position on sanctions as a member of the UK government with his wife's financial relationship with a huge company still doing business in Russia? As he told Sky, he didn't, and he didn't see the need to.
"I'm an elected politician and I'm here to talk to you about what I'm responsible for. My wife is not."
Not even Sunak's fiercest opponents doubt the sincerity of his defence of his wife. All the same, even his fiercest defenders were concerned by this development. According to one ministerial ally,
"This was a side of Rish that the public had never really seen. slightly testy and acting as if it was a bit of an impertinence for the media to even ask him the question. And, you know, fair play. He was protecting his other half, as anyone would. But that didn't make the question improper.
On Tuesday, the 28th of March, came the bluntest possible indictment from the Ukrainian MP Lesya Vasilenko. She was asked on LBC about Akshata Murty's holdings in Infosys.
Any money that is put into the Russian economy in one way or the other, be it directly, be it through investments, be it through taxes paid by companies which are operating in Russia, that money goes to sponsor the army, to buy the bullets that are killing Ukrainian children. Every company has a choice to make. You can run the business as usual and make your money, but then you have to live with the fact that that is bloody money and bloody trade.
At this point, Boris Johnson's officials started to take a keener interest. As one Downing Street aide put it,
"We knew that Sunak was already in deep shit over the statement, and that the Infosys thing wasn't going to help him. But here, you had a prominent Ukrainian politician accusing the Chancellor's family, in terms, of living off blood money."
So, Number 10 was not impressed when the Chancellor doubled down in a podcast interview with Laura Koonsberg on Thursday, the 31st of March. Instead of acknowledging the obvious problem that his wife was a shareholder in a company still doing significant business with Russia, Sunak clumsily compared himself to Will Smith, the actor who had slapped Chris Rock at the Oscars for making a joke about his wife.
"Keep my wife's name out your f***ing mouth!
I'm going to, okay?"
And to Joe Root, the then captain of England's cricket team that had just been roundly defeated by the West Indies.
"Yeah, someone said, you know, Joe Root, Will Smith and me, not the best of weekends for any of us. But I think on reflection, both Will Smith and me having our wives attacked, at least I didn't get up and slap anybody, which is good."
Whatever tensions had arisen between the two men, Sunak had always been implicitly trusted by the Prime Minister not to drop the ball under pressure. Now, here he was as Chancellor, trying to make light of the fact that, unlike Will Smith, he hadn't hit anyone for what they had said about his wife. A Conservative MP and former Cabinet Minister, who had previously regarded Sunak as a shoo-in to be Boris Johnson's successor, had this to say.
"Where was the Rishi Sunak we had come to love? It was the old joke that used to be made about Tony Blair. With Rishi, you have to take the smooth with the smooth. And here he was, clumsily asking to be congratulated for not actually punching people."
A minor stroke of fortune for the Chancellor was that the Commons was going into its Easter recess, denying Labour the immediate opportunity to embarrass him across the dispatch box. But that didn't deter Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, from piling on the pressure elsewhere, as he did in a Sky News interview on Friday, the 1st of April.
"I would have thought the Chancellor would actually want to come clean on this and say, actually, I can be very, very clear that my household doesn't benefit from any money that's come in any way from Russia during this invasion of Ukraine."
On the same day as the reputational damage accrued by the hour, Infosys announced that it was closing down its operation in Moscow as a matter of urgency, though it was reportedly still operating in Russia on the 3rd of May. How, meanwhile, were Sunak and his wife coping with the pile on? Their plan had been to take an Easter holiday in the family's California home, in addition to their £2 million Grade 2 listed manor house in Sunak's constituency in Richmond, North Yorkshire, a Kensington Mews home worth £7 million, paid for in cash in 2010, and a London flat used to accommodate visiting relatives. The Sunaks own a penthouse apartment in the luxury Waverley complex in Santa Monica, valued at £5.5 million. His team believed that it was not only politically justifiable for him to take a break, but physiologically vital. He had not had anything like a proper holiday since becoming Chancellor in February 2020. Now, however, he decided reluctantly to cancel his vacation plans, mindful perhaps of the flak that had been aimed at Dominic Raab for staying on holiday when Kabul fell to the Taliban in August 2021. As one of his team says, "We tried to gauge how bad it was, how damaging all this new attention to the family's wealth really could get." It wasn't news, after all, that Sunak had been a very successful banker and hedge fund investor before he became an MP in 2015. his wife's independent riches, as we've seen, dwarf his own. None of this had been an issue during the pandemic, when voters were more concerned about their family's health, their jobs, homeschooling the kids, and getting vaccinated. Sunak was constantly rated in opinion polls as the most popular member of the government, seen amid many failures and errors of judgment by his cabinet colleagues as the guy who could, in his own favourite phrase, get things done. It was a different time. How rich the Chancellor might be was, frankly, a matter of indifference while the country was fighting its long collective battle against a deadly virus. But now, the political context had changed completely. COVID had mostly fallen off the front pages, but inflation was rising, the tax burden was greater than at any time since the late 40s, energy bills were spiking dramatically, and economic growth was slowing. Suddenly, being a flashily rich chancellor was not such a good look. There had been a time when Sunak's cashmere hoodies, his Bluetooth-enabled £180 travel mug, and his evident love of the good life had occasioned only mild mockery. But now, as economic hardship sunk its teeth into millions, his family's wealth was attracting a different sort of attention, and none of it good. Could a politician as rich as Sunak understand what it was like to have to choose between food and heating, to skip meals so your children could eat? He had certainly done himself no favours by appearing tone-deaf when pressed on the question. Asked by BBC Breakfast's Nina Warhurst what accounted for the price rise in people's shopping baskets, he had got himself tied in knots.
What's your favourite loaf?
It's a Hovis, it's a kind of seeded thing. Well, we have a whole range of different, we all have different breads in my house.
Breads, plural. Earth to planet Rishi. Most voters only deal with bread, singular. Again, what used to be mildly funny was starting to become serious. In a photo op to publicise the 5p a litre fuel duty cut, Sunak posed in the forecourt of a London Sainsbury's, filling a Kia Rio at the petrol pump before paying and grabbing a Coke and a Twix. But the photo op, it quickly emerged, was the stuff of fantasy. The car wasn't even Sunak's. Pressed on the matter at the Treasury Select Committee, the Chancellor admitted that this was the case and that his family in fact drove a VW Golf. The Labour MP, Siobhan McDonough, was happy to brief Sunak on the facts of the matter.
I just wanted to let the Chancellor know that the cost in filling up my Kia Picanto has gone up from £30 to £54 in the time I've owned it. Mr Sunak, did you face a similar fuel hike in the time you've owned your Rio?
Even worse, the Chancellor neglected to mention that his Golf was only one of four cars that his family drove, and by far the most modest, the others being a BMW, a high-end Range Rover, and a Lexus. Always on top of his policy brief, Sunak was revealing himself to be an amateur when it came to self-awareness and political empathy. But wasn't the Chancellor meant to be the master of political presentation? Yes, he had famously hired Cass Horowitz, the social media and presentational guru, as a special advisor to raise his social media game. And Horowitz, in tandem with Allegra Stratton, the former television presenter who was Sunak's director of communications for much of 2020, had successfully constructed a brand Rishi on social media, especially Instagram. It worked up to a point. Sunak had become the master of the photo op, notably in July 2020, when he did a stint as a waiter at Wagamama on the South Bank to launch his Eat Out to Help Out scheme.
Hello.
Restaurants put dishy Rishi burgers on the menu. Weatherspoons announced their new discounts with a poster celebrating Dishy Rishi, legend. Even today, there are still Dishy Rishi t-shirts, badges and What Would Rishi Sunak Do notebooks available on Amazon. But gloss and political savvy are not the same thing. Hype isn't wisdom. Grasp of policy and how to sell it prettily in a social media post does not always translate into the deeper political instinct that a seriously ambitious minister needs. This became abundantly clear on the evening of Wednesday the 6th of April, when The Independent posted an exclusive by its economics editor Anna Isaac, bearing the headline, Revealed, Rishi Sunak's millionaire wife avoids tax through non-dom status. A brief word of explanation. Non-dom is short for non-domiciled individual and is an optional status open to a resident of this country whose permanent domicile is outside the UK. A non-dom only pays tax in the UK on money earned here and does not have to pay anything to HMRC on money made elsewhere in the world. Clearly, the arrangement meant that while her husband had been in charge of setting the nation's fiscal policy, Akshata Murthy had almost certainly avoided millions of pounds of taxes on earnings in India and other countries outside the UK. A Treasury spokesperson responded to the Independent story by insisting that the Chancellor's wife had had no choice in the matter.
India does not allow its citizens to hold the citizenship of another country simultaneously. So, according to British law, Ms. Murthy is treated as non-domiciled for UK tax purposes.
This was, to put it mildly, misleading. Non-dom status has nothing to do with citizenship and is entirely optional. Akshata Murthy had broken no law in choosing to be a non-dom, but she had made a decision. Alarm bells rang throughout the UK political world, mainly on WhatsApp groups, since most MPs were absent from Westminster because of the recess. As one of the Chancellor's political friends puts it,
"The initial Treasury statement was really bad because it compounded the problem of the story itself with what our enemies would see as a downright lie. It wasn't a lie. It was a mistake. But who the hell was going to believe that?"
Sunak, usually associated with zen-like calm, was, as another ally puts it, putting on a brave face but obviously close to losing it finally. In private conversations with allies, the Chancellor was already wondering whether he would have to resign. Indeed, whether he ought to preempt a painfully drawn-out departure by throwing in the towel immediately. How much support, more to the point, could he reasonably expect from his cabinet colleagues? He had shortchanged Michael Gove over levelling up, allocating a pretty paltry $4.8 billion to the government's supposed flagship policy. In February, he let down his friend and former boss of the Treasury, Sajid Javid, turning down the Health Secretary's request for an extra £6 billion to fund continued COVID testing. Sunak had reined in Nadeem Zahawi's plan for post-pandemic catch-up education, ignored Ben Wallace's warning before the spring statement that the UK was on course to miss its NATO spending commitments by 2025, and thwarted Kwasi Kwarteng's ambition for the fast expansion of the UK's nuclear energy capacity. And now he was paying a price for his fiscal prudence. Prudence which, by the way, he hoped would fund a pre-election tax cut that might well form the basis of a claim to the leadership. The political realities were bleak for Sunak. How could senior cabinet ministers be expected to rally round in anything other than a performative way when he had recently machine-gunned so many of their spending dreams?
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organization, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimize the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
Behind the scenes, he was relying heavily on his former comms director, Allegra Stratton, who is also a close family friend. Stratton had been forced to resign as director of communications for the COP26 summit in December 2021, after ITV News released footage of her in a mock press conference, apparently joking about a Downing Street party.
Is cheese and wine all right? No. It was a business meeting.
She had not returned to Sunak's payroll, but he trusted her implicitly to help him out of the worst jam of his political career. Number 10's snap instinct, meanwhile, was to defend the Chancellor and his wife, at least for now, on the straightforward grounds that Akshatamurti was not breaking any rules. In private, however, vanishingly few ministers and senior advisers believed that this line would hold. According to one Downing Street source,
"The closer we looked into it, the more it became clear that Mr. Perfect had well and truly shat the bed. A lot of us couldn't quite believe that someone as careful about his image as Sunak had made such a 101 error."
The Chancellor, however, decided not just to stick to the line that he had adopted from the start, but to dig even deeper. In an exclusive interview with The Sun's political editor Harry Cole, published on Friday the 8th of April, he denounced what he claimed was no more than a political hit job aimed at his wife and her entrepreneurial family. "To smear my wife to get at me is awful," Sunak said. "She loves her country like I love mine." Suffice it to say that the interview did not go down well within his own party. According to one cabinet minister,
"When I read that long ramble in The Sun, I just thought, he's toast. Bye-bye to all his leadership ambitions. He's certainly talented and able and all that. But Christ, how inexperienced can you be?"
To compound the sense that Sunak was indeed out of touch, those three deadly words, he was also forced to confirm claims that he had held a US green card until last year. This document permits non-American citizens to work in the US, obliges them to pay taxes on their worldwide income, and crucially, imposes an expectation that the bearer will make the US your permanent home. Sunak had indeed worked in the US as a high-flying financier before entering politics, but those days were behind him, weren't they? Tying itself in knots, the Treasury revealed that Sunak had given up his card only in October 2021, when he made his first work-related visit to the US as Chancellor. His allies insist that what they describe with a wince as the green card business was just an oversight. But to many Tory backbenchers, whose inboxes were full of emails about their constituents' growing hardship, it felt like a slap in the face from a man who hadn't really decided whether he wanted to lead the UK at a time of great adversity, or leave it all behind to be a 1980s-style master of the universe in a private jet. As one MP put it, "We began to wonder, is his mind really on the Red Wall or on Wall Street?" Either Sunak and his wife were being less than candid about the firmness of their plans to stay in the UK, leaving the door open to a future in India or the US, or they were merely playing the system to maximise their financial advantage. Neither scenario was likely to burnish their image. Those closest to Sunak saw a politician oscillating dangerously between defiance and resignation. His wife, unused to the brutality of public life, was also shaken by the speed with which everything suddenly seemed to be crashing down. Stratton was now running comms for Akshatamurti and decided that Team Sunak needed the help of a heavyweight professional. For this, she turned to Sarah Sands, the highly regarded former editor of the London Evening Standard and the BBC's Today programme, now a partner of the advisory agency Hawthorne. The decision had to be left to Akshatamurti herself, but Sands agreed with her that she should announce her unilateral decision to pay taxes in the UK on her overseas earnings, a significant shift. On Saturday, the 9th of April, the Chancellor's wife duly made a statement to this effect. Her non-dom status, she pointed out, was entirely legal. But, she continued,
I understand and appreciate the British sense of fairness, and I do not wish my tax status to be a distraction for my husband or to affect my family. I do this because I want to, not because the rules require me to. These new arrangements will begin immediately and will also be applied to the tax year just finished.
On the same day, a leak inquiry into the original independence story was announced in the Cabinet Office in the Treasury. On this second weekend of the Sunak affair, the Conservative Party was ablaze with gossip, rumour and speculation about what in fact had just happened and what it all meant. In which spirit, let us take a step back and look at four related themes of which this extraordinary story is a parable. First, it showed how dramatically relations had deteriorated in Downing Street between Sunak and his boss. True, the Number 10 team had gone through the motions of defending the Chancellor, but they hadn't exactly circled the wagons. At least one of the PM's closest aides was certain that Sunak would walk or we'd have to fire him. Now, that didn't happen, but there were close allies of Johnson who found it impossible to conceal their schadenfreude as the Sunak project fragmented before their very eyes. You'd need a heart of stone not to laugh, said one. From dishy rishy to squishy rishy, all in the space of 2 years. Remarkable. Johnson himself, I'm told, was careful not to join in these festivals of glee at the downfall of his political neighbour and rival, or to speculate about its finality. But, in the words of one who spent time with the PM during Sunak's travails, well, there was definitely a wolf-like glint in Boris's eye. You could see he was thinking, what goes around comes around. Sunak's team did their best to shrug off the sound of muffled cackling that was emanating from Number 10. According to one source, Rishi was absolutely convinced that Labour was behind the campaign against him and his family. But look, he's not stupid. He knew that there would be people in Boris's circle who thought Christmas had come early. It was easy by then to forget that Sunak had risen to the chancellorship as Johnson's man, willing to accept the conditions that his predecessor had refused to sign up to.
In the last few minutes, I've heard that the Chancellor, Sajid Javid, has decided that rather than obey the orders of the Prime Minister to sack his advisory team, he has instead turned down the second most important job in government and has decided to resign. In the interim, I'm just hearing...
Following a long-standing blueprint devised by his then-chief advisor, Dominic Cummings, Johnson had told Javid in February 2020 that he wanted to create a single team of advisers across numbers 10 and 11, the so-called Joint Economic Unit. Sunak, on the other hand, didn't see it as a problem.
In the interim, I'm just hearing that Rishi Sunak, who has been the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, is likely to be appointed Chancellor in his place.
At the time, indeed, the new Chancellor had to deal with the charge that he was just the PM's poodle, a yes-man installed at the Treasury to replace the more principled Javid. What Johnson had not foreseen, however, was that most members of the joint unit would soon gravitate towards Sunak rather than him. The Chancellor, it turned out, was also less biddable than Johnson had hoped, much more averse to borrowing than the PM, and keen to restore the Conservative reputation for fiscal conservatism as soon as the pandemic receded. If tax hikes were necessary, so be it. If spending had to be controlled, that was the price of economic stability. This wasn't how the PM saw the world at all, and he was dismayed to see Sunak consistently being backed by the advisers that the two of them shared. This wasn't just a question of personal loyalty, in other words. Sunak and his group of advisers were committed to the Treasury's economic doctrine of fiscal prudence and tight spending that owed more to the 1980s than to Johnson's belief in borrowing big to fund a pre-election cash bonanza. It was no accident that this Chancellor had a portrait of Nigel Lawson behind his desk. For all his shiny modernity, he was really a Thatcherite with an Instagram account. According to one pro-Johnson minister, the tensions were hard to nail down, but there was definitely this sense that a unit initially designed to ensure that Boris's writ ran at the Treasury had performed a reverse ferret and become part of Team Sunak. These were fairly vague accusations which reflected simmering distrust rather than outright conflict. But the animosity hardened in January when the Prime Minister was forced to apologise to the Commons for the infamous Bring Your Own Booze Downing Street party of May the 20th, 2020.
I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months. I know the anguish that they have been through, unable to mourn their relatives.
At the moment when Johnson needed him most, Sunak was conspicuous by his absence from the green benches, having travelled to Devon to visit a biotech company in Ilfracombe. The Chancellor said on Twitter that he was excited to be making the trip. Well, no doubt. But as he and the PM knew full well, it was the kind of non-essential visit that senior ministers cancel routinely when the heat is on and the boss needs your help. No less irritating was the fact that it took the Chancellor a full 8 hours to declare his support for the PM. In a Channel 4 News interview, Culture Secretary Nadine Dorries offered a novel explanation for this embarrassing delay.
We know he doesn't have great signal down there, and we know that it was a pre-arranged visit.
But do you think it was dodgy Wi-Fi, or was it actually just looking after his own potential prime ministerial ambitions?
To add insult to injury, Sunak also cut short an interview on Tuesday the 18th of January when asked if he supported Johnson unequivocally.
Well, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals. The ministerial code is clear on these matters. But as you know, Sue Gray is conducting an inquiry into the situation. I think it's right that we allow her to conclude that job.
And you support the Prime Minister unequivocally. Your microphone.
Oh, gosh. Thank you.
The pattern continued. Johnson was furious when on Thursday the 3rd of February, Sunak unambiguously distanced himself from the PM's insinuation that Keir Starmer, as Director of Public Prosecutions, had failed to bring charges against Jimmy Savile.
You know, being honest, I wouldn't have said it, and I'm glad that the Prime Minister clarified what he meant.
As far as Johnson's team was concerned, these were the weeks of maximum danger. On Wednesday the 22nd of February, Sunak had dinner with William Hague at Quaglino's restaurant just off Piccadilly. Nothing odd in that, you might think, but in this fraught context, Number 10 smelt a rat and lurid accounts of the Yorkshire tea plotters appeared in the Red Top press. Worse, some of Johnson's allies were certain that Dominic Cummings, now engaged in an open battle to bring about what he called regime change in Number 10, was pulling Sunak's strings, noting that Cummings was always fulsome in his praise of the Chancellor in his Substack emails, interviews and select committee appearances. They suspected, too, that the picture of the Downing Street garden party held on the 15th of May 2020 had been taken from the balcony outside Sunak's Number 11 office and had been leaked to the press with the help of Cummings or one of his proxies. Sunak's camp denies all this talk of conspiracy strongly and points out that Cummings and Stratton were always on a different page and that Rishi would always pick Allegra over Dom. But even without the involvement of Cummings, the relationship between Numbers 10 and 11 in January and February was now close to toxic. The distance between Boris and Rishi had never seemed greater or more dangerous, recalls one Johnson supporter. We were waiting for him to act, and we knew that if he did, he could well finish off the boss. But Sunak didn't act, in regard to which one Downing Street advisor quotes the poet Alexander Pope, willing to wound and yet afraid to strike. So even before the political crisis that faced the Chancellor in late March and early April, he was already regarded in the Johnson camp as much less dangerous than he had been. The threat level from Rishi had lowered by the early spring after he lost his bottle, says one official, and now, after all the tax stuff, it's non-existent. The same source also claims, with relish, that Sunak's fall marks the end of a long campaign against Johnson by Dominic Cummings. How apt that non-Dom should kill off Dom. So much for the shifting fortunes of the characters in the Downing Street soap opera. What does this parable tell us about Rishi Sunak himself and his character as a politician? There is no doubt that the Chancellor and his wife were genuinely shocked and appalled by what happened to them. Relatively few people had known about her non-dom status, which meant that this had been a breach in the circle of trust. In the Indian press, much offence was taken at the treatment of the couple. A lingering suspicion, in the words of one columnist, that this was no more than a lynching of a high-flying brown person. Strong words indeed, and a measure of the story's ripple effect around the world. Whether Sunak's undoubtedly erred was to believe naively that in politics following the rules is enough. It is in fact a necessary but not sufficient condition of political survival, let alone of success. David Cameron's stock may not be high these days, but he was absolutely right during the parliamentary expenses scandal in 2009, when he insisted that rules and regulations did not define the limits of a politician's obligations.
I was the first to come out and say that MPs had to pay back some money. Never mind that they were acting within the rules. Never mind they were given permission at the time. The fact is the system was wrong, and that's why the Conservative...
The Sunaks took a more literalist approach. They came from the world of business, of technocracy. In both cases, their parents were self-made, hard workers whose application had paid dividends, stratospherically so in the case of the Murty family. Following the rules was the whole point. Again, the unique and artificial circumstances of the pandemic had lulled them into a false sense of security. In November 2020, a Guardian investigation had revealed that Sunak's entry in the Ministerial Registry of Interests failed to list significant elements of his wife's business empire. It mentioned, as it does to this day, only her ownership of a venture capital investment company, Catamaran Ventures UK Limited, but not her directorships of the holding company of the luxury outfitters Duan Lingwood, of the gymnasium chain Digme Fitness, and of the international software development company Sirocco. The ministerial code is explicit that ministers have a responsibility to list interests of a spouse, partner, or close family member, which might reasonably be seen as directly relevant to the minister's public duties. In response to the Guardian scoop, the Chancellor took refuge behind the letter and detail of the rules and official procedure. But common sense alone should have prompted Sunak to go beyond official requirements and think about the hugely sensitive optics that are part of being Chancellor. On that occasion, the Sunaks caught a break. In the depths of the second national lockdown in England, the Guardian story soon fizzled out. But the revelation of Akshata Murty's non-dom status and the green card debacle, well, this time people were paying attention and were distinctly unimpressed by what looked like naivety or arrogance, or both. Some Tory MPs who had previously regarded Sunak as the natural choice to succeed Johnson started to wonder what they'd ever seen in him. This, thirdly, connects to the dramatic shift in political climate and the pressures to which ministers are now subject. In 2019, the Johnson government's electoral mandate was to get Brexit done. Next, it was presented with the historic challenge of the pandemic, a period in which Sunak's stock was extremely high and his performance constantly applauded by both the CBI and the unions. To be fair to the Chancellor, he more than anyone else saw that his early political stardom, like the spending spree upon which he was engaged, was unsustainable. Sooner or later, the pandemic would pass and the biggest credit card bill in history would land on the nation's doorstep. His enthusiasm to minimise COVID restrictions and avoid lockdowns was driven by the knowledge that the longer the economy languished in hibernation, the harder would be the journey back. And that was before the cost of living crisis.
Surging prices are inflicting what the Bank of England says will be the biggest single year hits to living standards in 30 years.
And the additional economic pressure of the Ukraine conflict.
On the streets, in the homes, and behind the wheels of this country, there's a cost to bear of a faraway conflict.
In 2020 and 2021, the public was afraid, and understandably so. They warmed Sunak's easygoing competence. Now, they are angry as prices soar, energy becomes barely affordable for millions, and taxes continue to rise. In March 2020, YouGov found that Sunak's net approval rating was plus 49%, well ahead of any of his cabinet colleagues. By last month, the figure had fallen to minus 29%. Contemporary politics is extraordinarily volatile, and in the populist era, public support is more fickle than ever. But Sunak's fall is not simply a matter of mere voter caprice or fashions on social media. It reflects a profound shift in the terms of trade. There is a new and hostile view of huge personal wealth, a sentiment which has naturally been turbocharged by the hard pursuit of Russian oligarchs since the invasion of Ukraine. In 2022, in other words, to be a super wealthy politician was to have a permanent target on your back, and the Chancellor had simply not adjusted to this new reality. He continued to believe in a fiscal conservatism whose time was past. He personified and clearly loved a tycoon lifestyle that was fast becoming a liability to his party. Nobody doubts that Rishi is a nice guy, says one MP, previously supportive of Sunak as Johnson's successor, now wavering. But is a Chancellor who thinks it's okay for his wife to be a non-dom really capable of speaking to Britain in the 2020s? Because these are going to be bloody hard times. It's a good question, and it leads to the fourth big theme of this parable, which concerns the future. With Sunak winged and possibly out of the picture completely, the race to succeed Johnson is both wide open and non-existent. Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary, Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, and a handful of others are gearing up to throw their respective hats in the ring. But they must wait for that ring to be set up. Denied the straightforward choice of Sunak, who once seemed to many of them the obvious oven-ready contender, Tory MPs must now absorb the lessons of the local elections and decide whether to stick with Johnson or to chance their arm with someone relatively untested. To say the least, it is not an appetising choice. As for Sunak himself, his most revealing act during the crisis was to move his family out of Downing Street on Sunday the 10th of April and into their Kensington townhouse. All this, his camp insists, was planned long before the non-dom disclosure and reflects in part the Sunak's plans for their children's education. But again, the impression was inescapably one of a family bolting from an address it was learning to hate and longing for the freedom of their real home away from the backbiting and attacks and intrigue. Has Sunak lost his appetite for the top? It certainly mattered to him that his name was cleared in full, which is why, on the very day that he moved out of Downing Street, he asked the PM to open an inquiry into the whole business.
Tonight, Rishi Sunak has written to the Prime Minister asking for an independent investigation into whether he's been fully transparent about his interests, saying he's confident such a review will show he played by the rules.
On Monday the 11th of April, the task was officially delegated to Lord Gyte, the independent adviser on ministers' interests. 16 days later, Sunak was officially cleared of all impropriety by the inquiry. There is no technical or official obstacle to the Chancellor carrying on as if business had gone back to normal. Clearly, it hasn't. For a start, the hunt will now be on to dig up more hidden or embarrassing details about his family's financial past. We know, for instance, that he was a director of his wife's company, Catamaran, until the eve of the 2015 general election. But is there anything else that has yet to be disclosed? This avenue of inquiry has been left wide open thanks to the Chancellor's poor political judgment. And, not for nothing, he has annoyed his cabinet colleagues by exposing their financial affairs to comparable scrutiny. At last count, only three of 22 cabinet ministers, Kwasi Kwarteng, Ben Wallace and Transport Secretary Grant Shapps, have confirmed that they and their immediate families do not use tax havens or claim non-dom status. Nadeem Zahawi and Environment Secretary George Eustace have made more limited declarations to the effect that they do not make use of this status. The real question is this. In boxing parlance, does Sunak have a glass jaw? Can he take a punch and get off the canvas? He has, after all, been the golden boy since he grew up in Southampton, became head boy at one of the nation's great public schools, scooped up a first at Oxford, achieved dazzling success in the financial sector, and then rose with astonishing speed to become Chancellor before his 40th birthday. It was all going to plan, but as Mike Tyson once said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Perhaps the greatest punch of all was the fixed penalty notice that he received from the police on Tuesday the 12th of April for briefly attending the Prime Minister's birthday party in the Cabinet Room on the 19th of June 2020.
The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, have both received fines from the police for breaking lockdown rules.
So, of course, did Johnson and his wife Carrie. But it felt to the PM's team that the Chancellor had finally been dragged down from the moral high ground. This, as one MP puts it, was levelling down in action. Speaking at Chequers just after 6 p.m, Johnson issued an immediate apology. Sunak, meanwhile, was both furious and dismayed by the Met's verdict and the £50 penalty, which seemed to tarnish even more seriously one of his supposed qualifications for the top job, namely that he had the integrity that Johnson lacked. Now it seemed that in a mere 20 days, that claim to integrity had shattered, a victim of the Chancellor's basic political immaturity. He dithered for 2 hours after Johnson's words to camera, wondering again whether he should quit. He was, he wearily concluded, trapped, at least for the time being. Just after 8 p.m, 6 hours after his fine had been revealed, he finally issued a statement, offering an unreserved apology and declaring that he understood that, for figures in public office, the rules must be applied stringently in order to maintain public confidence. I respect the decision that has been made and have paid the fine. Every one of those words was surely a paper cut to Sunak's soul, an admission not only of culpability, but of political paralysis. The Prime Minister has recovered from more disasters than he can list. However great his personal and political flaws, and boy are they great, he is not brittle. What about his Chancellor? Is the engine of his ambition and his desire to reach the top enough to get him through this crisis of confidence? Nobody has ever accused him of being a visionary. Does he in fact have a private dream up his sleeve for the future of the country that will inspire him to keep going? On Thursday the 12th of May, he will turn 42. This time last year, the country was still on the roadmap out of lockdown, about to mark step 3 of the relaxation of the rules, and Sunak was still riding high. His 41st birthday was a moment of strength and shining promise. These days, we're allowed to have parties again without the police getting involved. However he celebrates, the Chancellor is bound to reflect ruefully upon the difference a year can make and how viciously the wheel of fortune turns, even in the lives of the most gilded. What better moment, then, for Rishi Sunak to decide what forms of riches and rewards he really wants out of life, and more to the point, the price he is truly willing to pay. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Slow Newscast. It was written and reported by me, Matt D'Ancona. It was produced by Claudia Williams, and the executive producer was Jasper Corbett. The sound design was by Tom Burchill.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Slow Newscast. If you're not already a member, and really by now you have little excuse because I say it every week, then I'd love to invite you to join our newsroom. There's tons of bonus content and invites to online events, in-person events. So to become a member for £50 a year, which is half price, you can go to tortoisemedia.com/friend and use my code BASHA50. That's BASIA50. Thank you, and I'll see you next week.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organization, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimize the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
Hi, I'm investigative journalist Nicola Tallant, host of Crime World, a podcast all about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. Join me and my guests for a peek into the world of gangland crime, dirty money and mysterious cold cases. With 5 brand new episodes per week and sometimes even more, There's something for every type of crime podcast enthusiast. You can listen to Crime World now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.